Please be seated. How's that? How's that? Can you hear that? Working, but ours don't seem to be picking up. Yours is not picking up either, so. It's entirely possible that things... Just one second. Probably going to have to just shout for now. Yeah, I can. Ooh, thank you, Claire. Unusual that those seem to be working, but ours weren't. We figured it out. So before I get started, I'm going to point out that I have entered some portion of the 21st century. To my severe fright, my sermon is only on this thing. I was going to print it off as a backup, and the printer refused to print it. So this is it. That's one way to leap in, is to have the printer say, too bad. And it's also, I have the bulletin on here too. You all can also have the bulletin on your pad or electronic device, because we do have wireless in this space, and you can get it for free. There, Gary, wave, woohoo. Gary is one of our intrepid people who moved ahead on this, because it's Earth Day weekend, and so this seemed like a good weekend to highlight this again, that we're going to try to use less paper. We're continuing to have long bulletins so that it's helpful to our many visitors, but if we could do less printing, it would be a lovely thing, so I'm trying to do my part on that as well. Okay. Now, speaking of sort of science-y things, do you know that this coming Wednesday is National DNA Day? Is there anybody, are there any geneticists out there? I had no idea there was such a thing as National DNA Day. I found out about it on Friday. Apparently it takes place every year on April 25th. April 25th is the day in 1953 that the journal Nature published papers by the famous Watson, Crick, and others about the double helix structure of DNA. The first National DNA Day was celebrated on the 50th anniversary of that milestone, 15 years ago. On that day, April 25th, 2003, researchers announced that the Human Genome Project was essentially complete. In the U.S., National DNA Day celebrations are sponsored by the National Human Genome Research Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, which I know many of you have heard of in this room. Their website, www.genome.gov, offers this. April 2018 will mark the 15th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project. To commemorate this milestone and the genomic advances that have been made since 2003, the National Human Genome Research Institute has launched the 15 for 15 celebration, unveiling 15 ways that genomics has and will continue to transform our world. Starting on April 5th, that group has started and will continue rolling out one of those items on a day. Its April 10th installment was titled this: Human Origins and Ancestry, Illuminating Human and Family Origins at the Genomic Level. It's heavy stuff, but it's also stuff that individuals are getting more and more involved in as they send their own DNA off for ancestry testing. Coincidentally, I have been pondering human and family origins for a couple of weeks, ever since I picked up this, the April issue of National Geographic magazine. I'm going to walk through it in hopes that you can possibly see a little bit of what I'm trying to show you. This is a special issue that they call the race issue. A good chunk of it has to do with, directly or tangentially, genetics. To describe the cover for you, you can't quite see the details. These are two girls. The one on the left has pink skin, wavy, dirty blonde hair, and what seems to be green eyes. Our culture identifies her as white. The one on the right has brown, kinky black hair and brown eyes. Our culture identifies her as black. The words on the cover say this: black and white, these twin sisters make us rethink everything we know about race. One of the things you think we know about race is that race exists. we are now slowly discovering is that race is a construct. And that's one of the things this National Geographic talks about. The issue begins with the editor's examination of the National Geographic's own sometimes horribly racist content from the past. She notes, for example, that in a full issue article on Australia that ran in 1916, Aboriginal Australians were called savages who, quote, rank lowest in intelligence of all human beings. This issue continues with the article about the 12-year-old twins, fraternal twins, or I don't know, what's cisternal? I don't know what the word is for that, but fraternal doesn't really work, does it? These children are the children of an interracial couple. So one of the articles in here that really popped into my mind reading about National DNA Day had to do about current scientific knowledge about the origins of human beings and their migration around the globe. It's pretty amazing, really. This thing that I'm now reading is called the human diaspora. The human diaspora. I really like that word because it makes it sound more like we are one human family. I highly refer this issue to you. I'm just going to note a couple of other things. This title says there's more diversity in Africa than on all the other continents combined, and it shows photographs of people from different regions of Africa and all their genetic diversity. It's pretty amazing stuff. And also, there's a chart in here, it's very tiny for you to see this, but it basically shows when different groups moved around the globe. So what you'll see on this is that our common ancestors, considering the age of the Earth, started moving around pretty recently. Every human being that belongs to the species Homo sapiens, which emerged in a single location in East Africa. Our common ancestors all came from that single location in East Africa. They began to wander relatively recently, as I said. They reached westernmost Europe only 43,000 years ago. 43,000 years ago, that's not that long. In Europe, they intermingled with a few remaining Neanderthals. Therefore, most people of European descent carry some Neanderthal DNA. Another branch spread across Asia, and around 20,000 years ago, were poised to cross the land bridge over to northwestern North America. As the branches of the human tree moved farther and farther from the roots in East Africa, they evolved genetic adaptations appropriate to the climate in which they found themselves. I still, for some reason, this just seems amazing to me right now. Again, in all our incredible diversity, which is actually pretty well represented in this building right now, we all came from common East African ancestors, and we evolved into this diversity over just a few tens of thousands of years. To me, that says something, I'm not even sure what yet, about our current conversation about race and immigration. And I think, for me, maybe it helps to imagine human beings starting out as one really big flock of sheep, from which a few of those sheep started to wander. Today is Good Shepherd Sunday. Here's a little bit of liturgical minutia. I've discovered that people seem to like liturgical minutia, so I'm going to try to give a little more of it occasionally. The season of Easter, also known as Eastertide, lasts 50 days. Who knows when it starts? This is audience participation day again. Who knows when Easter starts? Dawn. Easter Sunday, kind of at the vigil, but we start counting day one as Easter Sunday, and it ends, the last day of the Easter season is Day of Pentecost. So Eastertide includes Easter Sunday through the Day of Pentecost, which includes seven Sundays in between those Sundays. Today is the fourth Sunday of Easter, and who knows what we always hear on the fourth Sunday of Easter. There's another name for this Sunday. You want to take a Good Shepherd Sunday. So every year, we have three liturgical years. On those 3 years, each year we hear a different part of the chapter 10 of the Gospel of John. We hear the first section in year A, the second section this year in year B, the third section in year C. So it's actually one continuous reading during which there's a lot of the word sheep. And it's long enough that it can be three standalone separate readings and still have plenty about sheep and shepherding and life-saving and all that wonderful stuff. So, you know, I love the imagery of the sheep and the shepherd, and that imagery of leader as good shepherd, king as shepherd, really goes way back into some of the earliest civilizations, and not just the Judeo-Christian civilizations. And part of it was that it would have been so relatable to those early listeners. Sheep were an incredibly valuable asset. They were a source of meat and milk and wool and then their pelts. So a poor family that owned sheep would keep them very nearby. And in fact, there are still some structures that maintain in the Middle East those kind of traditional constructions. And the sheepfold is literally one wall of the sheepfold is the wall of the home, and then it's fenced around, because they want to be close to those sheep so they can save them if something happens. And I feel pretty sure that those sheep would have known the voices of their masters. Now, John 10 actually echoes the words of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. I've said Psalm 23 with so many parishioners who are ill or dying that I can't even imagine how many that would be. It's really a go-to psalm because of its incredible comfort. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. Forget the translation that's in our Book of Common Prayer. Nobody wants that one. And so you just have to throw that one out, because we have our own translation in our Book of Common Prayer. That's another bit of liturgical minutia. We have our own translation of the Psalms. The Episcopal Church does. But when people are down, what they want to hear is this: the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. But sometimes I think we take those words for granted. We want them when we're sick. We don't necessarily pay much attention when we're well. And yet I think there's a lot going on there. You know, it's not just about comfort. I think part of being a good Christian is learning to hear those words for your own well-being, but also for the well-being of others. That it really talks about what is a Christian life, and how do we participate in a Christian life, and how do we participate in Christian community. I found the Episcopal Church in the fall of the year 2000, not that long ago really, after a fraught prior relationship with Christianity. Many of you have heard some parts of this story before. I knew the Episcopal Church was where I belonged from the first time I walked in the doors, but it still wasn't simple. Returning to Christianity, I had to reconcile with Christianity's history, both my history with it personally and Christianity's history institutionally. History related to homophobia and sexism and racism. It wasn't always easy or comfortable or fun. But fortunately, in this church, in the Episcopal Church, in really amazing congregations of this Episcopal Church, I found places where I could do all that work with integrity. Some of that work didn't even happen until I went off to seminary, believe it or not, which for some of us is just a leap of faith. But it's what we're supposed to be doing, even if we don't really understand what's going on. So it occurs to me that if Lent is about reconciling oneself to God, I'll say that again, Lent is about reconciling oneself to God, maybe Easter is about the church reconciling itself to us, in a way. I think that happens when the members of the church claim their place in the church, in its past, in its present, and in its future. It happens when the seeds that they sow by claiming their places start to shoot forth from the soil. There are a lot of different ways to do that, and we all have a role to play. You may have noticed that I've been preaching a bit more often lately. That's mainly because our other preachers have been less available recently. We'll get them back on the rota soon. But still, the timing was good. You regulars out there have been asked to help the vestry decide whether this congregation is ready to call a rector. And so I've been trying to preach a little bit in ways that connect to that question. As far as that discernment goes, you all have done your part, and now it's up to the vestry. But let me say this, just to make it clear. If you're looking for the good news, if you're looking for the gospel, all you have to do is look around. You are the good news. You are the gospel. It's true. It's absolutely true. So anything that I say is really only, I don't know, blather, I suppose, in some ways. God loves you. God has commissioned you. Jesus has given you everything you need. Your salvation is secure. You are the good news. I don't know how to say that any more forcefully. You are the good news. Every time you walk out this door, you carry that good news with you, even when you're not thinking about it. And sometimes when you are. So when I think about my hope for St. Thomas's, I suppose it's really simple. I hope that St. Thomas's is and remains and becomes even more so a healthy community of followers of Jesus Christ. It's pretty simple. Now, the first thing that most people think about when you say healthy congregation is financial health. That's related to attendance. So let me just say, yes, we need to be financially healthy so that we can sustain our life together. But financial health is necessary only so that we can be healthy in other ways. Financial health is a tool, not an end. Financial health allows us to keep this community moving and growing and being more bold as time goes by. Related to financial health is new members. Yeah, every church wants new members. Not that many churches get them. We have been. It's pretty amazing. And yet, we don't want new members just to shore up our financial health. We want new members because that's a mark of a healthy congregation. It's a mark of vibrancy. It's a mark of creativity. It's a mark of new ideas. It's a mark of challenge. Challenge to those of us who started here about what do we do about those who are coming to us? How do we need to change? How do we incorporate new people into our amazing congregation? So let's talk about what a healthy congregation might look like. When I talk about a healthy congregation, I mean that we are held together by bonds of affection that override any disagreements we may have. By healthy, I mean that we are seeking together always to hear what God is saying to us in this moment, in this place, at this time. By healthy, I mean that we open the doors and the windows to see what's going on outside and to integrate all that information into our lives of faith. By healthy, I mean that we are a place that helps people to grow in their relationships with God and thereby to grow in their relationships with all of God's creation. By healthy, I mean that we live in both contemplation and action. That is, we are both spiritual and religious, and that we explore what that means. By healthy, I mean that we have a family systems theory, that balances bone and sinew so that it is both strong and flexible, both steady and changeable, because that's what it takes to adjust to our continually new circumstances, be it new people here or new circumstances out there. By healthy, I mean that we continue to challenge ourselves to continue to understand what it takes to be radically welcoming, not just radically welcoming, but radically justice-seeking. The Episcopal Church mandates that dioceses require its clergy to participate in continuing education and to record that participation. Therefore, clergy of the Episcopal Church in Connecticut annually submit a reporting form about that. My form last year included at least one unlikely item, a behind-the-scenes tour of Yale Peabody Museum. Yes, the Peabody occasionally offers these free tours. They last an hour. But when the email blast comes out, you have to be quick to reply and get yourself on that schedule. They take about two dozen folks, and when I replied to the email that came in my box about 5 minutes after it was in, I got like one of two remaining spots. So I managed to get on a tour last November, and as the days led up to it, I was just ridiculously excited about it. I can't even explain it. I was just so excited behind the scenes at the Peabody. Ooh. You don't even know where they're going to take you. They just say, here, you get to go on this behind the scenes tour. But in a way, I think that made it even more exciting. You know, what will it be? You know. Well, as it turned out, we visited two sections, two scenes. We visited vertebrate zoology and invertebrate paleontology. Now, honestly, I couldn't have told you what invertebrate paleontology was when I got there. So it's creatures that have no skeletons and are fossilized, basically. So that was the first one. So I was doing pretty good, you know, not like trying to follow the tour guide around first and trying to be polite to the other people that were there. But then she pulled out a specimen drawer. They had these racks, giant racks of these giant drawers, and she pulled one out, and it was an ammonite. Who knows what an ammonite is? Well, this ammonite was about this big around. I don't know how much it weighed. And I wanted to sit on the, I wanted to sit on the floor and just hug that ammonite. I could have stayed there. I could have spent the night with that ammonite. I'm going to show you an ammonite. So an ammonite is a species that went extinct 65 million years ago with the dinosaurs. It's kind of a squid-like thing that lived here in the shallow. They started evolving about 450 million years ago and went completely extinct about the dinosaurs in about 65 million. You can see it has these phenomenal sight. It's really pretty cool. And, you know, I think they're going to the mathematics of the Fibonacci number, which is related to the spiral. I really don't know. This ammonite, by the way, I got from Books & Co. about a mile down the street that way, which has all kinds of great things, and I encourage you to go and frequent the store because it's woman-owned. So again, we're kind of talking about time, so I'm going to offer one more time marker. The age of the universe is set at the time of the Big Bang, which took place 14 billion years ago. 14 billion years ago. On the other hand, our ancestors have been on the move for, you know, 50,000. It's a recent history. Christianity at one time supported the idea that people of African ancestry were somehow less than human. There's a great article about that in here. In a wonderful irony, one might say that our African ancestors are the most human of all. And our friends of African descent are the most human at all, most closely related to those hominids who were all our ancestors. Thinking about Psalm 23, it was written about 3,000 years ago. The gospel was written down about 2,000 years ago. Again, thinking in context, what all this makes me feel like is that we are all somehow closer together than we often like to think. And that our time together on Earth is pretty limited. And we are really all in this together. If you're looking for a vision of where we're going as a congregation, let me just say that I'm looking for that vision too. I think we're supposed to do what we're supposed to do and try not to hold too tightly to the expectations about where that might lead. I don't know what it's going to look like. But I have some hopes. I hope that it is both as simple as that little free library out there and as grand as this stone building that we have been blessed to steward. I hope it's both as old as this ammonite and as new as this fresh flower. Amen.